This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 88 was recorded on November 9th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. The first three parts of our four-part Eurodollar University series featuring Alhambra Partners CIO Jeffrey Snyder were super popular with listeners. So for this week's feature interview, we're bringing you the fourth, but not necessarily the last part in this four-part series. In today's interview, Jeff and I will move past the theoretical discussion from the last episode and dive into the names of actual people and companies who participated in the Eurodollar supply expansion leading into the 2008 crisis. Now, you're probably wondering how it's possible that part four of a four-part series could possibly not be the last episode in the series. So be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when we'll tell you about what we're planning. If you liked Eurodollar University, you're going to love the special shows that we have planned for the holidays, which were only made possible by the generous donations we've received to help defray our production costs.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500, all I can say is volatility is back. I mean, even though it's only been a 1% swing and then a bounce back from there, it really feels like we haven't had this kind of volatility in months. I mean, the S&P 500 has kind of rolled off of just under 2,600, hitting about 30, 40 S&P points lower at a low point of about 2,565. And as we're recording here, it's trading around 2,577. What's your take on the market here?
Well, you know, the thing that scares me is the fact that people are freaking out over a 1% pullback. And I hope it goes a few more percent. I don't think it's going to last. And, you know, I could be wrong. I certainly think that on any fundamental level, it's time for this market to move sharply lower. But I don't think we've seen the setup for that yet. So if we move a little bit lower here, I think I'm going to try putting on the ratio call spread that you talked about last week just to maybe get some upside from this market. I don't see any reason that now should be the time that we suddenly have a crash. And, you know, this volatility that we're seeing would not be abnormal in the slightest bit. It's just typical day-to-day volatility in the old normal. In this new normal of no volatility, maybe it looks a little bit unusual. But I, for one, don't think it's the beginning of the end or anything like that.
It certainly will be very interesting to see whether those buy on dip traders come back the way we've seen them do repetitively month after month throughout the 2017 year. Nonetheless, let's move on to the dollar index because it looks like that 95 level has marked sort of the short-term overhead resistance and we're leasing a little bit of selling here on the dollar today. What's your take here on the dollar?
Yeah, we've pulled back here on Thursday to still just a little bit from where we were last few days. And I still think this uptrend is in play. Remember, we've got so much going on right now politically between international geopolitical events that we'll talk more about when we get to oil. But, you know, the appointment of a new Fed chair, the confirmation process and so forth, I think this dollar situation is not really going to show a profound sign of a new trend direction until some of this stuff gets resolved. So as far as I'm concerned, the jury's still out, and I don't think the small pullback that we saw today on Thursday is any big deal. I'm going to wait and see what happens after we get to the next step with the Fed chair and so forth.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because the last couple of weeks have just been straight up moves for crude oil, now hovering over well into the 57 handle on the upside. What's your take here on crude?
Well, to be sure, if there's anything that possibly could go crazy, wild, or nutso in Saudi Arabia, it did this past weekend. So we have a lot of geopolitical stuff to talk about. Let's start with inventory, though. Crude oil building 2.2 million barrels this week nationally, and of that, 720,000 was a build in Cushing, Oklahoma. So that's bearish for crude oil. The thing is, that was kind of overshadowed or outweighed by a 3.3 million million barrel drawdown in gasoline and a 3.4 million barrel drawdown in distillates. So finished products are drawing down harder than expected. That means the net petroleum stock drawdown, if you consider both crude oil and finished products, ended up being negative. So overall, it was bearish, but not super bearish signal for crude oil and a bullish signal for gasoline. And we've seen that divergence in the charts. Production ticked up a bit, though, rising to 9.62 million barrels per day. Exports are either down, if you want to talk about compared to last week, or still way up compared to any historical norm, 869,000 barrels. Of course, that's a daily number multiplied by 7. You've got 6 million barrels of oil exported last week. Tape action has been really pretty crazy. I think if you look at what happened on Wednesday, inventory day, we saw a big push up. Probably it was the last day also of the ETF rolls from one contract to the next, touching what so far has been a high at 57.87 or so, and then retracing all the way back down to where it started. We're moving a little bit higher on the day today, Thursday, as we're speaking mid-afternoon. We're taping the show a little bit early today so we can get Eurodollar University out. I'm looking at 57.28. If we move above, I'd say 57.55, 56 or so, that would suggest maybe we are going to still go higher from here. Now, I've said in the past that I've been bearish. I think that this rally is overextended, and I still hold that view in terms of the technical analysis and the general big picture. But the thing is, in the oil market, technical analysis goes out the window when geopolitical things really start to hit the fan. And holy cow, Saudi Arabia, I can't imagine our listeners haven't heard the news, but there has been a major shakeup. A lot of people are trying to figure out, was this really a corruption probe as it's advertised to be, and that's why they arrested and seized the assets of all of these princes and so forth? Or was this some kind of a counter coup to avert a coup that was maybe trying to get rid of Mohammed bin Salman? Or was it a preemptive strike to prevent such a coup from happening? You know, people analyzing this, trying to figure out what's happening, I don't really think it matters that much. The message here is there's a lot of instability in the kingdom. There's a lot of infighting. Exactly what's going on, that's beyond my pay grade. But what I do know is that Saudi Arabia has ordered all of its citizens that are in Lebanon to get out ASAP. That potentially means there could be some military conflict coming with Lebanon. There's just a whole lot going on. So as much as I continue to think the market ought to be topping out here by any reasonable technical measure, we're overbought and it's time. Even if you think that, okay, it's a new move higher, we're headed to much higher oil prices, the market is really and truly rebalancing or even tightening, as some people are starting to say. Even if you believe that narrative, and I'm not quite persuaded of it yet, although I'm starting to come around a little bit more in that direction, still, we're way overbought. It's time for a pullback. On the other hand, you know, if Saudi Arabia starts a war or Mohammed bin Salman gets killed in a coup or something, everything could just go crazy overnight, and there's no limit to how much upside there could be in a crisis situation. So I think that the thing to do is to be hedged, to be careful, and not to assume too much. If the geopolitical tensions settle back down and some of this geopolitical risk comes out of the system, I think we're overbought here and due for a pullback, maybe to $53 or so. As far as whether we get a big pullback all the way down into the low 40s, say, as I was expecting a few weeks ago, I'm not nearly as convinced of that scenario, but I think we're way overdue for some kind of pullback.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because I would have at least thought that as volatility returned and the dollar pulled back, the gold would get a really good kick to the upside. I mean, we are back to about the 1286 level here on bullion, but it really isn't a huge uptick. What's your thinking here on gold?
Yeah, you know, I continue to feel like until this dollar index direction is really clear, and to me that means after the whole Fed chairman issue is resolved, then I don't really have a firm direction on gold. I would say Jeffrey Christian's call of 1260 being a buy, you know, 1260s somewhere in the 1260 to 1270 range. So far, since he made that prediction on the program, you know, we've seen a lot of tests into the 1260. 1260s. We haven't been below 1260. So I think that number is probably still a buy if you're looking to buy. Personally, I'm not looking to buy. My desires around gold are to wait and see what happens with the Fed share, where I think the dollar is going. I really don't have a view on gold until I have a stronger conviction about my view on the dollar. And at this point, my view on the dollar is I kind of am still in the secular bull camp, but I need to see what happens.
Moving on to Treasury bonds, we have the 10-year yield still hovering around 233, that we haven't seen any big movement here in the last few days. What's your thinking here on yields?
Well, as you think you just said it, there hasn't been much movement, and even if there had been a little movement, it wouldn't tell me anything. The trading range here is 2 spot 12 to 2 spot 64. A breakout in either direction from there would send a strong message. In the meantime, I think what we're doing is treading water, waiting to see who the next Fed chair is going to be, waiting to see what monetary policy is going to be, waiting to see what comes next. I don't think there's much of a story to tell about Treasury bond yields, frankly. On the other hand, something we don't normally cover, but we probably ought to, I sat, Patrick, for like 2 years on a big short position on junk bonds on the JNK and HYG ETFs. And I just really thought the fundamentals were lined up for them to move lower in price, higher in yield. And it didn't happen, and it didn't happen, and it didn't happen. And so I finally gave up on that trade. And now look at what's happening. So I think we're at, what is it, about an 8-month low on price on those junk bond ETFs. And on one hand, I think that the risk that was inherent to junk bonds coming specifically from the shale patch, that's kind of reversed now with the turnaround in oil prices, where I was afraid we were dealing with oil prices in the low 30s, and I'm thinking these guys are never going to be able to pay the debt service on their bonds. Well, now they're selling their oil at a much higher price. I think they can service their debt. But something else is sending us a pretty clear message here, because junk bond yields and spreads to treasuries particularly have really started to move. Any thoughts on your side as to what's driving this?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, I think that treasury bond market is not really telling the story. I mean, really, we've all seen a reversal in emerging market bonds. And the interesting part there is emerging market bonds have rolled over, but emerging market stocks, using something like an EEM, remain very close to their highs. But you move on to exactly like you were talking about, the junk bonds, the JNK or any of these high yield bonds, we're finally seeing the selling coming in. And it's pretty intense. But, I want to put some context on that, because, you know, when you go to something like the St. Louis Fed using their FRED software, you have basically the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, U.S. high yield option adjusted spread, which is measuring that spread between treasuries and that of junk bonds. We hit a low of around 338 in the spread, and we've now gone up to about 367. But what's interesting is if you look back at all the crisis that occurred, junk bond yields and the spreads here spend a lot of time north of 4%. Like if you go back to 2014, during that period you were talking about with a lot of the energy company junk bonds being in question, the yields, the spreads went from 4% all the way to almost 9% spread. And it literally spent well over a year and a half above that 4% level. And so I'm curious, even though it looks like it's a big deal that we're at 8-month lows, we're nowhere north of 4% on the spread. And so it makes me kind of ask the question, I mean, are we still like in the first inning of something? Like, is this a bigger turnaround in the spreads, or is this just a short-term blip? It'll be very interesting for us to maybe comment on it here on the show every once in a while.
You know, just as you're talking there, kind of a light bulb went off in my head. I don't have a well-thought-out thesis to share with our listeners, because I just thought of it when you said that. But what it makes me want to kind of think about is my thought experiment for the weekend is, hey, wait a minute, how do we get here in this crazy stock market that a lot of us think is ridiculously overvalued? A lot of it was share buybacks, and those share buybacks were financed with junk bond issues. So if it's time for things to start unwinding and for this crazy stock market that has never made a whole lot of sense to me, that valuations are so high, to finally come down, is it different this time in the sense that the junk bonds are the first thing to let go rather than equities? Normally, we think of bonds as being much more stable, less volatile than equities. You know, equity is at the bottom of the capital structure. But what's financed the buying of all the equity for the last few years? The issuance of just an unprecedented amount of junk bond paper. So, you know, could we be seeing the beginning of something where this time around, the way the equity market unwind happens, it's actually led by junk bonds, and there is a signal here. I just thought of that. It came into my mind as you were talking. So I'll think about it maybe next week in our postgame segment. We can discuss it some more.
Well, I have to completely agree with you, Eric, because you know what? While I'm not really a treasury bond bear the way we have a lot of guests out there, but I do believe that there will be a correction in bonds. But my speculation definitely has to do with these lower grade corporates and a lot of things like lower grade sovereigns that all have such tight spreads over treasury that these spreads could really widen. And that could be a driver of some of the market risk that we see moving forward. Nonetheless, part four of the Eurodollar University with Jeffrey Snyder is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Today's feature interview with Alhambra Partners CIO Jeffrey Snyder was pre-recorded back in July of 2017 as part four of our Eurodollar University project. There's a slide deck to accompany this interview, and we recommend that you download it before listening, as we'll be referring to the charts and graphs that it contains throughout this program. Registered users at macrovoices.com will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, go to www.macrovoices.com and look for instructions to register and get the download link next to Jeffrey Snyder's photo on our homepage. This four-part series came about after listeners to the Macro Voices weekly podcast asked for more in-depth coverage of the Eurodollar system. In part one, we discussed how the Eurodollar system came about, how Milton Friedman demonstrated in a series of articles that fully $30 billion in new U.S. dollar money supply was created by the Eurodollar system in the 1960s, and how this occurred at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen, without a single penny of actual cash issued by the Treasury or a single ounce of gold bullion to back this $30 billion of new money supply. In part two, we learned about the wholesale component of the Eurodollar system. And we discussed the role that the repurchase market, which is used by banks to secure short-term financing, played in expanding the wholesale Eurodollar market. We also discussed why investment banks went on a collateral buying binge in the early 1990s, and how the Fed's policy to target the Fed funds rate rather than money supply was probably influenced by the Fed's inability to accurately measure the money supply because of explosive growth that was occurring in the wholesale Eurodollar market. In part three, Jeff explained why he believes that much of the economic growth through the 1990s that most people attribute to then Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan was actually due to money creation that occurred through expansion of the wholesale Eurodollar market, which Jeff believes most observers didn't understand at the time. We then went on to discuss the role that the Basel Banking Accords played in enabling the further expansion of leverage in the banking system and growth of the wholesale Eurodollar system. Finally, Jeff walked us through a series of hypothetical examples, which illustrated how the banking system grew the Eurodollar wholesale money supply. In this final part, we're going to move past those hypothetical scenarios and talk about some actual examples using the names of real companies and people. So without further ado, let's jump back in right where we left off. Here's Alhambra Partners CIO, Jeffrey Snyder.
Again, we want to keep in mind that over time, this behavior evolved more and more at the margins. And that originally, you're right. I mean, banks, the role of banking society is to manage savings. And that throughout this evolution of the Eurodollar system, that role or that intention became eroded and replaced by this, what really is a bastardization of the entire idea of not just banking, but money itself. And so that, you know, that stuff still went on. I mean, banks were still lending to companies so that they could invest in their vital operations and do productive things with it. But the whole concept of savings itself was obliterated and replaced with what is essentially a system unto itself. And in fact, I think in the housing mania portion of the middle 2000s, it became to that kind of an extreme where this financial system just for no other reason than just expansion for the sake of expansion. Because, you know, your point about regulators and a regulatory review is well taken. But by their own standards, these banks were behaving according to regulatory standards. Nothing we see here is illegal. And that's an important point to stress as well. This is not illegal. It's just a very poorly designed system where the flaws apparent in it that are very apparent today weren't readily anticipated at the time.
Now, Jeff, in the last series of slides that we've been through, we're talking about Bank A, Bank B, Bank C. Obviously, these are fictional entities. Let's try to pull this together in a real-world example of how real, actual financial entities have manipulated balance sheets. And, you know, give us an example. I think that's what you're coming to on slide 45.
Yeah, and slide 45 is a company called Primis Guarantee, which is probably a firm that nobody's ever heard of. And there's really no reason you would have ever heard of it, except the fact that Primis wasn't just some unnamed firm out in the middle of the street. It was founded by a guy named Tom Jasper. Now, Tom Jasper was a giant in the derivatives industry who in 1985 practically invented the interest rate swap, or at least the modern standardized contract, or what became the modern standardized contract. And because of that, he was named the official first chairman of the ISDA, or at least I believe it was a co-chairman. And so, you know, Primis Guarantee was founded by a guy who was a legend on Wall Street, especially in these types of things that we're talking about here. And so all he had to do was raise a little bit of capital and then started writing credit default swaps. And what I've presented here is the height of the housing bubble, you know, 2004 and 2005. And what you see in analyzing their balance sheet, even though Primis had written about $14 billion in gross notional in CDS across 535 entities, it doesn't really appear on the balance sheet. That $13.5 billion shows up in the notes. And all that does appear on the balance sheet is, again, the market value of those contracts, not the guarantees themselves, but the market value of the contracts, which were a fraction of the total obligations if those CDS were ever converted into actual default events, which, of course, Primis judged to be a very low probability because they were written on high-quality names. In fact, Primis actually failed in 2009, I believe, not because that they were going to have to pay out on those CDS contracts, but because the probability changed where that they might have to pay out more than the capital they had on their books. And so they had guaranteed an enormous amount of contracts and swap premiums based on a very thin liquidity margin. And on their balance sheet, they had, something like $600 million in cash and investments netted out by $200 billion in long-term debt. So they had basically $400 backing $13.5 billion in CDS.
Moving on to slide 46, I think that's really just a summary of what you just said a minute ago as we're talking through the information on slide 45. But as I come to slide 47 here and see AIG's logo, this one really got my attention. I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with the way that AIG had to be bailed out during the financial crisis because they had written so much credit default swaps just across the board with so many counterparties that if they had failed, it would have basically created a domino effect that could have taken out the whole financial system. So I think a lot of our listeners probably knew that part. I was amazed here when I read your slide that more than half, the lion's share of all of that CDS that AIG wrote with no particular reserves or ability to service it, that was being sold to people who were buying it for the purpose of playing this game of manipulating their balance sheets in order to qualify for a reserve ratio or a capital requirement that didn't realistically reflect the risk that they had in their portfolios. It's just amazing. Why don't you talk us through this story and how AIG fits into the whole Eurodollar story?
Yeah, I think most people would be surprised not only that this took place, but to the extent that it took place and where it really mattered the most. I mean, AIG had somewhat of a shaky reputation even before 2007, and largely because they had been transformed from an insurance company into what was essentially a money dealing company. Not only were they involved in credit default swaps for regulatory capital relief, they also were heavy into the securities lending business, which is the rehypothecation that we talked about earlier in the repo markets, because as an insurance company, they had a portfolio of securities that were just sitting there doing nothing. And they figured, well, why don't we, add an additional spread to our income stream and start lending out securities? So AIG as a whole was into a lot of these types of hidden shadow type activities that allowed the euro dollar system in the aggregate to run in all of these various ways that it did. And so as one of the central parts of that system, a failure in AIG would have been catastrophic. I mean, at least that part, Secretary Paulson was correct. I don't think anybody could accurately predict what would have happened had those credit default swaps gone too much further awry, or even any some of the other parts of AIG's businesses. One of the worst parts about it is that for the Federal Reserve, at least, when they took over AIGFP's portfolio, they never lost a nickel on it. In fact, I believe they made in Maiden Lane II $4 billion profit. So the issue here wasn't ever default. I mean, AIG didn't actually have to pay out on the credit default swaps. The issue, as always, is volatility and liquidity. AIG could not handle what was in 2007 and 2008, an uptick in modeled and expected volatility that reduced the probability that AIG was going to be able to pay out on credit default swaps should it ever have to. And in the course of doing so, as AIG was being forced to reevaluate all of these positions that it had written before, what had happened is other counterparties started asking for collateral from AIG that it didn't have. And so AIG's issue was one more of liquidity than solvency. Because again, you know, AIG wrote all of these credit default swaps under the idea that it was just going to pocket those premiums and never pay out a nickel. If you think about it in the terms of a traditional insurance company, that's what they, you know, was the best of every world for them. They were going to get paid to essentially guarantee against something that would never possibly happen. But that was the basis for, as they note explicitly on their 2007 annual report, that was the basis for this regulatory capital relief going on primarily in Europe. And so it kind of ties together in a real world example of everything that we've been talking about up to this point. You know, the euro dollar system is offshore plus wholesale. It's all of these various other, I guess a good way to think about it is the money multiplier effect that doesn't have any money involved in it. You know, how can these banks and how can these dealers create leverage from nothing or from, you know, at least accounting gimmicks or through derivative trades? And so that is what happened. And AIG was in the middle of a lot of those different dimensions and streams that in 2008 would have made a bigger deal than it already was.
It's just amazing to me, Jeff. I keep waiting for you to get to the end of the list of all of these things that have happened that just fuel this creation of more and more euro dollars. And I see here on the very next slide, we're not done yet, because there was legislation introduced in the late 90s called Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which supposedly was intended to provide a better experience for the retail customer. One-stop shopping. You could buy all your financial products, your mutual funds, your life insurance, and everything in a bank branch. And the idea was that this was sold to the public as a way for Americans to get all of their financial services needs met in a single place. But you're saying here that's not really what the real story was. It's another excuse to create more euro dollars.
Yeah, is it ever always, you know, that kind of a sunshine thing? It's, oh, this is great for the people. I don't know if it's ever that way in any of these kinds of things. But that's exactly what happened. You know, we're talking about the evolution of the eurodollar system. One of the final impediments for it to go completely crazy in the way it did in the 2000s was this restriction between traditional depository institutions and what were investment banks, you know, or insurance companies, or, you know, companies like Travelers or AIG. What Citigroup, the first to actually try to test those limitations, what they were really after wasn't so much that they wanted to sell Travelers insurance products in their depository branches to their depository customers. They wanted Citigroup as a depository institution to better be able to manage their balance sheet in the way that shadow banks had been doing it, these investment banks had been doing it all along. In other words, they wanted in on this game of expansion and leverage. And the only way that they could possibly do that was by removing Glass-Steagall. They had to obliterate the last legal restriction for the depository side of the banking system to get involved in the shadow side of the banking system. And that's exactly what happened. Right at the end of the tail end of the 1990s, it all came together, including some of the other smaller dimensions that we hadn't talked about and probably won't get a chance to get to. But it all kind of came together around the year 2000 and 2001, where everything was working in the direction, as we talked about before, of sort of expansion just for the sake of expansion. And you're absolutely right to point out before that banking is supposed to be a societal beneficial transformation of money into credit into economy. And when all of these things started to come together in the 21st century, it just went way off the rails. And that's why we ended up getting so much carnage by 2007 and 2008, because it became, you know, I think insane is probably too strong of a term, but I think you know what I mean. It completely lost all sense of itself and all sense of societal purpose.
And of course, Henry Paulson, who was head of Goldman Sachs in the late 90s, personally played a very instrumental role in lobbying for the removal of Glass-Steagall, eliminating that set of restrictions and laws that were designed to protect the system, and then went on to be in charge of coping and dealing with the mess that was made as a result of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which he took credit for as being the savior and the guy who was the hero in the story. It's absolutely amazing. Jeff, we've been talking at a high level about some of the things that were happening in the late 90s. Let's look at the hard data in terms of what the result was in the early 2000s. So starting with slide 49, why don't you talk us through the data that you're presenting here in terms of the result of some of these actions of the late 90s?
Well, slide 49 is data taken from the Office of Controller of the Controller of the Currency, one of the regulators of the banking system. And so they compile call reports from each of the banks, primarily the large banks that we're dealing in, especially credit derivatives. And what we find is the derivative system, or the derivative part of the euro-dollar system, going essentially parabolic in the 2000s. In other words, once all of these evolutions in money started coming together in the late 90s and early 2000s, the system just took off on itself. Here we have on slide 49, credit default swaps that just go parabolic. We've been talking about this idea of a money multiplier creating leverage in the banking system out of nothing more than what was really an accounting thing. The point, I think, is really that the Federal Reserve had a role here. In the middle 2000s, of course, Alan Greenspan in the Federal Reserve under Greenspan, he states in order to slow all of this stuff. Theoretically, that was the way it was supposed to work. Starting in June 2004, the Fed was going to tighten monetary policy through the federal funds rate, which was supposed to transition into the rest of the system. But we see very clearly here, especially in credit default swaps, they pay absolutely no attention to monetary policy whatsoever. And so, you know, the idea going back to the beginning here that the Federal Reserve is at the middle of the monetary system is just wrong. You know, the euro-dollar system evolved outside of the Fed. And by the time the Fed started to get a sense that something was awry, it was already too late. And so monetary system, the full nature of the euro-dollar system, again, these cross-border flows between American banks trading derivatives with European banks and European banks supplying euro-dollar to some bank in Japan, and all of the stuff taking place far beyond the ability of the Fed to actually control it on the way up.
So slide 49, talking about credit derivatives, was entirely about credit default swaps. I see here on slide 50, the next slide, that we're moving on to interest rate derivatives. And then on slide 51, it looks like we're talking about bank derivatives more broadly. So walk us through these next couple of slides. What's this story telling us?
We have to be mindful that the examples you presented before are only one angle to this. In other words, you know, the credit default swaps usage in regulatory capital relief are only one angle for balance sheet, I don't want to say manipulation, but management. In other words, how derivatives played a role in giving banks the ability to maintain and create leverage. Interest rate swaps were used for another tool of balance sheet management, which is volatility. And so even though we didn't go through the examples of this, there are other avenues of managing a balance sheet so as to create the maximum efficiency from the point of view of the bank. And so in the middle of 2000s, again, what you see with interest rate derivatives like credit derivatives is that there's absolutely no response to what the Federal Reserve is doing, because there is absolutely no way for the Federal Reserve to play itself into this space. The banks were intent on expanding. And we have to remember, by and large, at that time, they felt there was very little risk to doing so. In other words, even though things were growing parabolically in some places, they believed that there was no risk to that, because everything that they had created throughout the decades before, they thought had been tested enough, especially in 1997 and 1998 with LTCM, so that it could withstand anything. And oh, by the way, if things did get out of control, they actually believe the Federal Reserve would provide a liquidity backstop if it was ever needed. And so we have this assumption, which is really an inherent contradiction, that we can create or at least present banks that show very little risk who engage in monumental amounts of risky behavior. And so the system itself was, again, inherently contradictory because that just doesn't work. That the real world just doesn't work that way. And so it was doomed for us almost from the start.
It just blows my mind, Jeff. You know, you hear about all of these people that work in finance and very senior positions in risk management. And to the casual layperson, you would assume that means that they're managing risk. But what you're saying here is that those people are really working on how to manipulate and redefine their balance sheet to exploit loopholes and weaknesses in regulations that are designed to actually manage risk in order to reduce their capital requirements and take on more risk. So they're not really risk management. They're people whose job is to figure out how to get away with taking on more risk than the books show there to be. And it blows my mind that this industry actually works this way. Let's tie things all together now. On slide 52, we're going back to one of the very first pictures that we presented in the first episode of this series, which is just sort of showing us how the banking system is meant to work. So bring us up to date, or maybe pull this all together in terms of the big picture.
Yeah, well, we started out, we had this acceptance market, or banker's acceptance market, that was intended to mediate global trade. You know, you make this point, you made this point before, which is a tremendous point, was, you know, the monetary system and the banking system are supposed to provide the economy with necessary resources so that economic activity can take place. And that's what's supposed to happen here. And what happened over time, especially from the 1960s forward, and then particularly in the 1990s forward, was that as the Eurodollar replaced other forms of mediation in global trade, what actually happened was it became a parallel banking system unto itself. In other words, it was funded by these euro dollars in all of these various dimensions, not so much that a company in Japan could import goods from Sweden, but so that the banks in Japan or Sweden or Switzerland or anywhere around the world could participate in this euro dollar system that at the time was stoking a U.S. housing bubble, while at the same time creating vast bubbles in emerging market, what we call today hot money. And so what we're describing here is almost an entire massive complete system, monetary and otherwise, that existed offshore and wholesale into the shadows because there was no regulatory authority. There was no government authority, good or bad. There was no government authority over the conduct of this system. It was kind of essentially a self-contained system that operated beyond the reach of everybody around the world. And of course, that was a particular point of failure in 2007 and 2008, because when push came to shove, when the system started to realize the contradictions between risk and return, there was nothing there. You know, we go back to some of the initial slides where we went through the initial euro dollar deposit making that Milton Friedman described in 1971. It's essentially euro dollar is a figment. It's a phantom, as I called it, because there is no euro dollar. There is no thing called a euro dollar. All it is is a system of banks trading liabilities that allow them to manage their balance sheets in a manner that is hugely risky with great leverage that doesn't appear to be risky.
So again, it's the people that most lay people would assume are employed to manage risk who are actually engaged in manipulating regulations and figuring out ways to exploit loopholes in order to take more risk than the spirit of the regulations was intended to allow, but still to comply with the regulations to the letter of the law, while making things so complicated that it's extremely difficult for most people to look at a balance sheet and even understand what's going on there. Moving on to slide 53, it looks like you're drilling back down into some of the details of how this accounting works. So let's continue with this story, as amazing as it is. Well, what's happening here on slide 53?
And I also want to make one more point about what you just said. And I think we have the benefit of hindsight here, and also for the benefit of being outside of the system looking back in. I'll bet if you ask any of the AIG managers back in 2005, like let's say, they would have said that, you know, we're not manipulating things at all. What we're doing is what we believe is positive business, low risk business, because we believe in the mathematical models that we've created that show us exactly what we're doing and what we're supposed to be doing, what our counterparties are doing. I don't want to get too far in assigning blame as if this was an intentional act of sabotage almost, but more so the fact that I think it was a failure of imagination. I don't think the people working inside of it could see the whole picture. You know, they got lost in the forest because they were paying attention to the individual parts that each one played out and each one acted out. From the perspective of that time and of that age, it did look like it was a stable system. It looked like the math was all good. The math was all legitimate. All of the models, all of the regulations appeared to be working because, let's face it, from the 1990s and even into 2000s, the economy was relatively decent. 1990s much better. Inflation was low. It did appear like everything was working as it was supposed to. And so when a person at AIG was writing credit default swaps, they did so under that understanding or under that paradigm where they thought all of this stuff was legitimate. And of course, it is hard, I think, for somebody in that position to stop and say, hey, what are we doing here? This doesn't make sense. And, you know, and it becomes a contradiction where I don't think it's easy at all to swim against the tide where, especially in the banking system, you either grow or you die. You know, for a bank to say, hey, I think we're doing something wrong here. I'm going to stop doing it. Well, they know very well that they're going to be gobbled up by the guy that is. And so I think there's an element here of almost psychology where it becomes self-reinforcing, the herd instinct of humans anyway, where because everybody's doing it and everybody appears to think that it's working, that it's everybody at the end believes that it is.
Indeed, those are excellent points, Jeff, and I agree with you that at the time, I'm sure it seemed to the people involved as though they were doing the right thing. But of course, systemically, in the end, it proved to be a disaster. Let's go ahead and briefly just cover what you've got on slide 53 here, walking through some of the numbers.
Yeah, I think 53, we just want to sum up what we're talking about with the Eurodollar, using Bank B as our primary example. Bank B has constructed its balance sheet through short-term wholesale funding, borrowing from Bank A, which is our stand-in for the money markets in the wholesale format, expanding their leverage as much as they possibly can, while at the same time doing so through engaging derivative activities primarily, presenting themselves as little risk as possible. And I think what we're really getting toward here is, you know, when Bear Stearns failed, how could it fail as a well-capitalized bank that had enormous leverage? I forget the exact number, but it was 33 to 35 to 1. Lehman Brothers, the same thing. You know, these banks were well capitalized by the Basel standards, yet they had enormous leverage. And so what we're reviewing here is how that happened. You know, how did these banks create money and credit from nothing so that what looked to be sound system, especially for those, as we just said, inside of it, really wasn't. In fact, it was a dangerous system that included so many different points of failure. Primary among them was this geographical divide between the Eurodollar and the domestic system.
So we've been talking at quite some length now, Jeff, about the mechanics of how this Eurodollar system expanded. Let's take a step back and look at the big picture of where this left us as we move on now to slide 54. This whole process we've been discussing creates more and more Eurodollars, more and more dollars that are essentially money that's been conjured out of thin air by these complex systems that banks use to manage their balance sheets. How big is this whole picture by the time we get to the end game?
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest problems with all this is the term shadow banking is appropriate because all of this stuff takes place not just outside of our view, but as we've gone through throughout this presentation, it takes place outside of balance sheets or traditional accounting. And so, you know, all along, we don't really know exactly to what extent the Eurodollar system grew. And it wasn't until after the crisis was over that people started to go back and take a look at exactly what or how big that the system had gone. And one of those attempts was by the Bank for International Settlements in October 2009 that went out there and looked at, bank balance sheets and call reports and BIS statements and all sorts of stuff. And what they saw was that the outstanding stock of banks, when they use banks here, they mean all global banks in all jurisdictions, but their foreign offshore claims grew from $10 trillion in 2000 to $34 trillion by the end of 2007. So not only was it enormous expansion in cross-border funding and cross-border credit creation. It was all of this was taking place in a place that wasn't supposed to exist. So it was an enormous hidden, misunderstood, misplaced banking system, misplaced monetary system that was just waiting to be a big problem.
Now, I want to ask you a question about how well the regulators understand these issues, because I've certainly learned a huge amount just from doing this series with you. I was aware of the simplest definition of a euro dollar as being, you know, a dollar denominated in United States currency that's on deposit in a foreign bank someplace. This whole wholesale model and how it has contributed to the expansion of money supply is new information to me, and I thought I knew a lot about this stuff. Do you think that Janet Yellen and the rest of the FOMC members understand all of this? Is this all old news to them? They understand all these workings. They understand the extent to which euro dollars have expanded in the system during the last couple of decades and what it might portend in terms of what's coming next? Or is this still something where even the senior regulators don't fully understand the big picture?
No, economists and regulators they might have some inkling there's something going on outside of their purview, but they have decided long ago that none of this matters, that it's all unimportant. You can go back through the academic literature throughout the history, and what you'll find is, especially in the 1970s, U.S. officials totally denying the euro dollar as money at all. And I'm talking about just the deposit end of it, let alone the stuff we've been talking about here. So officially, none of this stuff exists. As far as economists are concerned, the U.S. economy is a closed system. In other words, it has its own money supply. There are trade linkages to foreign sources, but monetarily, there isn't supposed to be much of a transit between the U.S. and outside the U.S. Now, obviously, the Fed was aware of the euro-dollar market going back to the 1960s, but the extent to which it grew, especially qualitatively in all of these various facets, it's beyond the orthodox canon, the orthodox framework of understanding how all of these things work. So when Janet Yellen sits today and analyzes the money system, she analyzes the money system from a perspective where none of this stuff really exists.
You know, Jeff, I find slide 56 really interesting because a view that I've held for a long time, since the financial crisis at least, is that this rally that we've seen in stocks since March of 2009, I think has been fueled primarily by excess liquidity supplied by central banks. And as much as I really think that that's been the driver, I have to look at a longer-term S&P chart and think, well, gee, you know, all of that accommodation from central bankers that's occurred since 2009, that wasn't happening in the 90s, yet we still see a very steep trajectory of the S&P 500 moving dramatically to the upside during the 90s, which, of course, it was a boom time for the economy. But it sounds like, if I'm assimilating this whole picture, and please correct me if I'm wrong, what you're really saying here is that it was around the time that the euro-dollar system started expanding, which has a very similar effect to quantitative easing. It's providing a whole bunch of new liquidity from sources that not everybody really understands or is used to in the system. That may have actually been responsible for some of the stock market boom in the 90s. And now am I overreaching to assume that that's what you mean with this slide?
Eric, I think that's exactly right, that the reason we got asset bubbles in both the stock market and the housing market in the United States was the fact that the Eurodollar system was growing exponentially at those time periods. In other words, the shadow system was creating both the liquidity as well as the credit resources for those things to actually happen. And it's not coincidence that, at least in my opinion, that we see this major inflection in especially stocks and housing in the United States around 1995, because that is when the Eurodollar system, especially under now JP Morgan's risk metrics program, that is when the Eurodollar system really started to fully mature into its final state. In other words, where all of these various parts of balance sheet management and money multiplication without money, cross-border financing conduits, and all those kinds of things really started to happen, and to happen in a way that made a big difference in how things changed and how things evolved.
And as we move on to slide 57, looking at housing permits, it looks like we see a very similar inflection point. It makes me wonder if what's going on here is these games that were being played as a result of the Basel Accords were somehow enabling popularity of mortgage-backed securities to really expand dramatically starting around that same time, 1995. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think people in 2007 and 2008 were wondering why were German banks failing from housing in Florida, California, and Arizona? You know, there was an incongruity there that was never really fully explained. And that's exactly what we're talking about here, is that, the U.S. asset bubbles were not just, limited to the middle 2000s, nor were they limited to just American banks. It was a global phenomena where this euro-dollar liquidity, along with its ability to expand leverage, created the resources and the financing that allowed those things to happen. And in addition to all of the things that happened in China, Brazil, and emerging markets around the world, it was an enormous asset bubble that scarcely didn't touch one part of the world.
And I see here on slide 58 that we're just seeing more of the same, that around the time that the euro-dollar system started to really expand, that's when we see both volatility and a lot of bidding up of asset prices. So this has been a fantastic and very fascinating series for me. I'd like to ask you, just to summarize, at this point, how many people really understand this, and what are the consequences now that the euro-dollar system has grown so dramatically and you have this wholesale creation of money supply that's going on as a result of unorthodox mechanisms that a lot of people don't understand? What are the potential knock-on effects, consequences, risks, and so forth that you see as we continue to operate in an environment where money is being created that not everyone understands?
The biggest problem is the fact that we don't understand what happened. If you don't understand what happened, 10 years ago, let alone 50 years ago, then you don't really know where we are or why we are where we are. And that's a problem for not just monetary policy, but anybody that lives in the global economy. We're forced to live with the consequences of the effects of what was really unfettered, unrestrained monetary growth that went on for so long that it just got totally out of hand. And so the consequences of it are that when it actually started to doubt itself, when the euro-dollar system started to be aware of its contradictions in 2007 and 2008, there was nothing that could be done about it. The Fed couldn't step in because where would it? Even in the quantitative easings that happened afterward, whether it was in Europe or in the United States or even Japan, none of those really had much of an effect because once the euro-dollar system started to fall apart, there was no stopping it. And so the lack of a global recovery after the Great Recession is a monetary problem. And it's one that the Federal Reserve, so long as it persists in believing that the United States is a closed system and that the Federal Reserve is at the center of the U.S. money supply, will never be able to fix. It will never be able to solve it. And that's exactly why it has not. It has failed time and time again throughout the last 10 years because it's not even involved in any of these kinds of qualitative expansions. And I think that's what really the point here is through a lot of this is that, we think of asset bubbles and we think of, monetary imbalances as sort of a quantitative phenomena. But that's not what the euro dollar was. I often get asked, what is a euro dollar? It's straight out. And I can't give an answer because there is no thing that is a euro dollar. It's a system that evolves qualitatively, transforming the entire definitions and nature of money right down to the ground foundation of it. So until we go back and really understand what happened, I don't think we're going to be able to solve the problems that we are faced with today. We're still in many ways on step one, which is getting a handle on all of this stuff that actually is, rather than what authorities and economists and policymakers theorize is supposed to be.
Well, Jeff, I'd like to thank you tremendously for a fantastic series here with Eurodollar University. And just to set the context for our listeners and maybe to set some expectations for next steps, the way that this came about was we've had you appear several times now on the Macro Voices podcast, and we got very different feedback. Most of our guests, some of the listeners love them and some of the listeners hate them. What we got from our listeners in response to your appearances was, wow, this is obviously a brilliant guy, but even our finance professionals were saying, we don't even know what he's talking about with some of the background. You've got to start from the beginning and get into euro dollars. What does it mean? Why is this market important? And that's what brought about this Euro Dollar University. So I think the next step is we need to invite you back on Macro Voices to do another of these interviews where we'll set this entire series as a prerequisite so that our listeners hopefully will have taken the time to listen to this series to know all of this background. And with that background under their belts, I'm going to ask you to give us perspective on current markets, current events, what you see going on, what Eurodollar futures are telling you. And I'd like to get you back so that we can really tie together where we're headed in the future, how the past that this whole system has taken us through translates to what we can expect in the future and what the current signals are. So after we've aired this entire series, which is originally conceived as a single one-hour session, it's obviously grown to much more than that now. Once our listeners have heard that, we're going to invite you back on the Macro Voices podcast to do a perspective on current markets and current events that takes into account this Eurodollar system. And I think it's going to be fascinating. So listeners, be sure to stay tuned for that. Before we close, I'd like to summarize the key points that we covered in all four parts of this series. In part one, the story began in 1944 when the U.S. dollar was chosen to serve as the world's reserve currency at the Bretton Woods Conference. Because this meant that the dollar would be used for all international trade settlement, that meant that all other nations around the globe needed to have dollars in order to transact international commerce. By the 1950s, an offshore market for U.S. dollars had developed in the form of the banker's acceptance market. Effectively, banker's acceptances were like money orders or cashier's checks that were payable in U.S. dollars. These dollar-denominated IOUs were the first incarnation of the Eurodollar market. By the 1960s, there was a full-fledged offshore Eurodollar market operating entirely outside of the U.S. banking system and therefore without U.S. regulation. But the Federal Reserve didn't even gain awareness of what was going on in the Eurodollar market until about 1962, when the phrase Eurodollar first starts to appear regularly in FOMC minutes. Through the 1960s, the Eurodollar system created new U.S. dollar money supply out of thin air at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen, with no backing by gold or by physical cash issued by the U.S. Treasury. And all of this happened in the 1960s, when the United States was still on the Bretton Woods gold standard system. In a series of articles, Milton Friedman demonstrated how the Eurodollar system had created $30 billion of new U.S. dollar money supply out of thin air, without gold or physical cash backing. Because all of this was happening outside the U.S. banking system, it was exempt from regulation that would have otherwise prevented it from occurring inside the U.S. banking system. Not wanting to be left out of the profits that were being made by offshore banks, the major U.S. banks established European subsidiaries so that they too could participate in this opportunity to conjure money out of thin air without gold backing. And the key point to remember is that through all of this, the new money that was being created at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen somewhere in Europe was never backed by an ounce of gold or a penny of actual money issued by the U.S. Treasury. It was all occurring entirely in the shadows, and it was exempt from oversight or even the awareness of U.S. regulators. Then in part two, we went on to expand the conversation into the wholesale component of the Eurodollar system, which essentially allows U.S. banks to create money supply out of thin air through creative accounting. We learned that by 1974, the Fed realized that they didn't know how to measure the money supply accurately because the system had become so complex. We discussed how the repurchase system, which is used by banks to facilitate short-term financing, played a key role in expanding the wholesale component of the Eurodollar system. Officials at the time were challenged to even understand what was happening and didn't know how to categorize repo transactions because their full effect was not completely understood. Official statistics of the day did not accurately reflect the money supply that was being created in the wholesale Eurodollar system or the role that the repo market played in creating it. We heard the fascinating story of how major banks, Salomon Brothers most visibly, were overbidding for treasury paper in the early 1990s because they'd figured out a way to beat the system and rehypothecate the very best collateral assets, using them to collateralize multiple loans, thus effectively conjuring even more money out of thin air using the repo market to create wholesale eurodollars. Jeff opined that the Fed's literal inability to accurately measure the money supply that was being created by the eurodollar system probably played a key role in the early 1990s policy shift in which the Fed began targeting the Fed funds rate rather than money supply as a monetary policy tool. Then, in Part 3, Jeff described Alan Greenspan as an accidental genius, suggesting that what seemed at the time to most observers to be organic economic growth through the 1990s may really have been bolstered to a great extent by new money supply creation that was occurring in the wholesale eurodollar system. And, of course, that money creation has a stimulative effect, similar to what quantitative easing was intended to accomplish in the wake of the Great Financial Crisis. We discussed the role that the Basel Banking Accords played in enabling banks to increase their leverage considerably while maintaining the same on-paper capital ratios, thanks to provisions of the Basel Accords that allowed some collateral, including mortgage-backed securities, to enjoy a special discounted reserve ratio requirement. This led to increased demand for mortgage-backed securities to serve as collateral to fuel the growth of the wholesale eurodollar system, and that extraordinary demand may have contributed to the overall failure of the investment community to realistically price default risk in those securities. Off-balance sheet accounting further enabled growth and expansion of the wholesale eurodollar market, and Jeff walked us through a series of hypothetical examples illustrating how this process occurred. And then finally, in this episode, Part 4, we heard the story of Wall Street legend Tom Jasper's Primus Guarantee, which wrote $13 billion of notional credit default swap exposure entirely off balance sheet, leading to its eventual failure in 2009. Something I never learned until this interview is not only was AIG at the center of counterparty risk in 2009, but much of the credit default swaps they'd written were sold to banks who were using them to play accounting games and further leverage their balance sheets through the eurodollar system and its ability to create money. So AIG was all over every aspect of the eurodollar system, from credit default swaps to repurchase agreements. We heard how the Graham-Leach-Bliley legislation was sold to the public as an enabler of financial one-stop shopping, supposedly good for the consumer, but how in reality it enabled retail banks to play in the same euro-dollar wholesale money creation playground that the shadow banking institutions had been enjoying for years. Jeff explained that the Fed was asleep at the switch in the early 90s, focusing monetary policy decisions on the Fed funds rate, with no apparent cognizance of the massive money supply creation that was occurring at the time in the wholesale eurodollar market. We discussed how, although the supposed purpose of the banking system is to facilitate the efficient formation of capital to finance the expansion and creation of new businesses, ever since the 1960s, the eurodollar system has really taken on a life of its own, creating bubbles as money creation occurs in the shadows, with no regulatory oversight or even awareness on the part of regulators that it was occurring. Jeff opined that this contributed to the 2007-2008 housing crisis because the demand for collateral to facilitate eurodollar money creation helped to fuel the bubble in subprime mortgage-backed securities. Jeff explained that even to this day, hardly anyone really understands how big the eurodollar system is or the role that it plays in the global financial system. Regulators basically don't pay attention to it. It's not on their radar. Economists don't recognize the eurodollar system in their models. Jeff believes that eurodollar system money creation fueled the 1990s stock market boom, and few people appreciate that point. And finally, the point that Jeff made most emphatically is that we cannot possibly expect that the problems and risks that are being created by the growth of the eurodollar system to ever be corrected until first regulators develop an awareness and understanding of the system's true inner workings and the risks that it poses. That concludes my summary of all four parts of this series. And now I'd like to share a personal recommendation with our listeners. Now that you've listened to all four parts, I recommend that you go back and listen to some of Jeff's past interviews on the Macro Voices podcast, which you can still find on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Jeff was featured on August 18th of 2016, then again on February 16th of 2017, and then again on May 25th of 2017. Just look for Jeff's picture on the homepage as you scroll through all of our back episodes. Now, longtime regular listeners, I know what you may be thinking, but I already heard that show and I remember what it said. Look, my experience going back, because frankly, I didn't understand the wholesale aspect of the Eurodollar system when I taped those interviews. I only learned about it when we did this series. My experience going back was I learned a whole lot more listening again with the benefit of this background. So I really encourage you, if you are interested in this material, to go back and listen to those interviews. But that's just my suggestion. Your mileage may vary. Jeff, I want to thank you again. Before we close, though, let's just give our listeners a quick rundown on what you do at Alhambra Investment Partners.
Well, I basically focus on dollars and euro dollars. Alhambra Investment Partners is an investment advisory firm, a registered IRA. And what we do is try to make sense of the world so that we can invest intelligently and prudently. And unfortunately, in trying to do that in the last 10 years, and even longer before that, has been incredibly difficult because, as I hope your listeners have appreciated through the presentation here, the world doesn't look like it the way it's supposed to look. And so there's a lot more to this story that is very much relevant to 2017. Somebody once said that you can't know the future without studying the past. I believe that wholeheartedly, and I think, at least I hope, that what we've done here will help people understand that as well.
Well, we're going to leave it there, folks. Believe it or not, talking to Jeff off the air, he had to cut a lot of content out to get this series down to its current size. There's quite a bit more content, certainly a lot more in Jeff's brain. We're going to be tapping that as we invite Jeff to come back every several months for an update on what signals the Eurodollar market is sending us and what we can expect in financial markets and the broader global economy. So be sure to tune in for that, and thanks again for joining us on this Eurodollar University. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Now, Eric, what a great series this was for this Eurodollar University. You know, I've always understood credit and money, and I've always known that these money center banks were able to create money through having reserves and creating credit. But it was, in my mind, always something that was top down from the Fed, and the central banks actually were able to manage and control this. But, you know, when I listened to this entire series on this Eurodollar University, it actually is just blows my mind to think that there's an entire money market system out there that the Fed doesn't even know how to properly control, or even what its impact on the economies are. Now, what was your takeaway from this?
Well, I've had the benefit since we recorded this back in July, and I've got the keys to the kingdom here, so I've been able to listen to it ahead of everybody else. I've actually listened to the entire series three or four times now, and this is one of the few that I really have found, if I can give our listeners any advice, it really is worth considering another complete listen to the whole program. What I've found is on the first listen, I'm understanding the mechanics of what Jeff's talking about. He's teaching me about how, okay, this is what the rules of the Basel were. Here's a spreadsheet that shows you how the Basel Accords affected the rules, and this is why mortgage-backed securities. Okay, I'm getting the concepts that he's explaining directly. That was about as much as my brain could absorb on the first pass. When I listened to it the second time, I knew that stuff. I remembered it from the first time. So what's happening is on the second listen, the wheels start turning in the back of my head, and I'm just thinking as he's going through the Paul Mosier story, and I think it's part three, I'm going, wait a minute. I remember those years, and I remember what I thought was driving the economy, and, you know, it's the internet is new, and it's taking off, and e-commerce is a big thing, and people are all excited, and it's the future. I didn't know that banks were conjuring money out of thin air after Paul Mosier went and overpaid for treasury collateral because they figured out a way to rehypothecate it. So the second time through, it wasn't really listening for the sake of the individual concepts that were in Jeff's slide presentation. Probably the second listen, you didn't need to be looking at the slides because it was really, for me, just putting a big picture together of how my memory and understanding of monetary history is probably misinformed by not knowing about this stuff. And then the third listen, it was really just kind of pulling everything together and thinking about current events in the sense of, wow, there's this whole other money supply system that I'm not used to thinking about the fact that it exists. And it just makes me that much more excited to get Jeff back because, frankly, I thought I understood all of our previous interviews with Jeff before we did Eurodollar University. I thought I got it. Well, I went back and listened to one of our first interviews with Jeff, and I'm listening to myself asking the questions, and I'm like, dude, you're asking the wrong question. Don't you know about, you know, Paul Mosier, and don't you know about this, and, you know, ask him this. So I'm really looking forward to doing another interview with Jeff where we're not doing the historical university about Eurodollars, but where we're incorporating current economic circumstances into the Eurodollar informed conversation, if you will.
Well, with that said, Eric, let's not keep our listeners in suspense. You were talking about our year-end show. Why don't you let our listeners know what you were thinking?
Well, I'm really, really excited about this one. And I have to emphasize, we weren't planning to do this. Originally, Eurodollar University was going to air over the holidays so that we had something pre-recorded, and that was our plan. We got some really generous donations, a $1,000 donation. We've got three $500 donations so far, and more $100 donations than I can even count. And it really makes a difference. It makes it possible for us to produce and bring you more content. So we accelerated Eurodollar University, and I got back in touch with Jeff Snyder about what I just described a minute ago, which is we'd like to do something more. And I said, Jeff, let's bring you back and put something together for, let's look at the current economic environment. And particularly, I think one of the most important questions in everybody's mind is the direction of the U.S. dollar. Where is it headed? You're a dollar bull. Let's set a prerequisite that people are not going to understand if they didn't listen to Eurodollar University first. If you've got Eurodollar University under your belt, we're going to go deep and we're going to talk about the argument for the dollar. Jeff pushed back a little bit and he said, Eric, you know, I really, really want to do that with you, but I really enjoyed making Eurodollar University with Macro Voices. It gives me a chance to really get my thoughts organized. But, you know, even in the professional finance community, I never get people that will give me feedback about my work. They just look at me like I'm crazy to spend so much time on Eurodollars. And I thought about that and I said, okay, you asked for it, buddy. So what we're going to do for our probably Christmas week show, it'll be a two-part series over 2 weeks. The first part in that series, it's going to be first a critical feedback on Eurodollar University, and then Jeff is going to make his case for a secular bullish view on the U.S. dollar. And he's going to frame it in the language of Eurodollar University, talking about what's going on in the Eurodollar system. And he's going to make that bullish argument. But he won't be making it just to me, because he asked for it, he's getting it. We're going to bring in some pretty tough dollar bears, Luke Groman and Mark Yusko. will be the recipients of this message. And Jeff went way out of his way to reach out to me and say, hey, this is the best thing ever, but I want you to tell those guys, don't be polite, don't be nice to me, give me critical feedback, tell me what's wrong with my thinking, tell me where the holes are in my thinking. So we've got Luke Grohman and Mark Yusko revved up right now. They're working on slide decks to push back on the view that Jeff is going to share with us. And so we're going to have Jeff, dollar bull case, it framed in Eurodollar University language. Mark Yusko, Luke Grohman are the audience, as well as myself. We're going to critique his presentation, and then we're going to turn the tables the following week. And it will be both Mark and Luke making the dollar bearish case. They'll have a slide deck. Jeff's going to have that ahead of time. And Jeff and I will be the audience giving them critical feedback as to any holes that we might find in their logic. What I love, Patrick, about all three of these guys is when we called them up and pitched this idea to them, they all said exactly the same thing. They said, look, I don't want to be in a debate and try to prove my view is right and the other guy is wrong and have a competition. It's childish. It's a waste of my time. Don't want to do it. But boy, to be with those two other guys and just to have a professional discourse and say, hey, I'd like to show you a few slides, talk to you about my ideas, get your feedback, show me your work, let me try to see if I can give you any insight into what you're doing. Let's just do this for the sake of professional networking and trying to learn from each other. That's the circumstance I want to do it under. And I said, guys, that's perfect. You guys talk shop, talk about euro dollars, talk about dollar bull or bear case as three professionals talking to one another with our audience listening in. So that's going to be the two-part series. We're not sure exactly what the date will be, but it'll be 2 weeks in a row over the holidays that we'll be running this special. We haven't recorded it yet, but I have been in touch with Luke and Mark, and they've got the message loud and clear that Jeff wants critical feedback on the content in Eurodollar University. These are really, really busy people, and they have been kind enough to take the time to actually listen to the full series, read the full slide deck, and prepare some critical feedback. So we're really excited about this project.
You know, Eric, I'm really excited about that year-end show. I think it's really going to be interesting to see what comes of it and whether or not we can start to really deduce some real biases toward where the potential next dollar move is going to be. Nonetheless, what's on your mind for the rest of this postgame?
Well, you know, I want to do it a little differently. Usually we just do a quick wrap at the end where I ask you to give a very quick summary of what's in our research roundup email for listeners this week. Thing is, this week we've got one piece in particular that I really think deserves its own coverage, not just as a, by the way, there's a link, but hey guys, this one is really worth your attention. So Patrick, why don't you explain what this piece is about, who it's from, and why we think it's of particular interest to our listeners this week?
Well, in past shows, I've often referenced Marko Kolinovic from JP Morgan, who's a quant over there. And they came out with an article, and I just thought it was so very well put that I felt it was worthy of spending some time talking about it. Now, the title of the piece is, What Will the Next Crisis Look Like? And it was written by Marko Kolinovic and Bram Kaplan. What it really talks about is what will things look like here as we move forward? And what's interesting is they coined a new term in here, which I want to give them full credit for. They say, we will call the next hypothetical crisis the GLC, the Great Liquidity Crisis. You know, so we have the Great Financial Crisis of 2008, and the next one is already coined GLC. And really what it comes down is that they think that the main attribute of the next crisis will be a severe liquidity disruption resulting in market developments. And they go through a list of what are some of the reasons they believe liquidity is going to be where the problem is. And so I want to share a few of these ideas that they have in terms of that. And the first one they have is, and they highlight the decreased assets under management of strategies that buy value assets. And I found this really interesting. It says, obviously there's the shift from active to passive assets, and specifically the decline of active value investors. It reduces the ability of the market to prevent and recover from large drawdowns. It's this idea like, okay, look, if you're a Warren Buffett and you've got billions and billions in cash as a value investor on the sideline, well, as soon as there's a market downdraft, well, the value investors are in there to take advantage of the cheap prices and cause the recovery. But their argument goes on that $2 trillion of rotation from active to this passive momentum strategies has occurred since the last crisis. And really, this idea is that this eliminates this large pool of assets waiting ready to stand by to buy up these cheap assets.
You know, Patrick, I find that fascinating reference, the conversation we sort of accidentally fell into in our pregame market wrap, because if you think about what's going to happen, let's just take their proposition at face value that the next crisis is all about liquidity. There's suddenly going to be a drying up of liquidity. And what you would presumably have to look at in that scenario is, okay, what are the assets that people are going to be forced to dump in order to raise money that there's no buyer for and where things just go no bid? And it takes me back to the junk bonds, because if there is an asset where people tend to have an attitude change when a market crisis begins, you know, junk bonds, of course, they don't like to call them junk bonds when things are good. High yield. These things are fantastic. They produce double the yield of treasury bonds. It's their high yield. They're fantastic. Well, guess what? When the shit hits the fan, they're junk again. And if we get to all of a sudden, there's this just massive, massive issuance of junk bonds. A lot of it came from the shale patch. I think more of it came from corporate buybacks. All of this stuff, you know, people think of it as bonds, the safe money. It's the investment that's not dangerous like stocks. It's bonds. It's safe. Well, it's junk bonds, and it could probably be more risky than equities in a liquidity crisis. So I wonder if that junk bond action is kind of signaling something on the horizon. I'll qualify myself to say I'm thinking of this stuff. I'm making this up on the fly as we're talking here. I haven't prepared anything for this show, so I'll need to think that through over the weekend. Maybe we can talk about it more next week, but it really speaks to me. You know, the question to ask yourself is, in a liquidity crisis where what's going on is, you know, regardless of whether people think things are undervalued or fairly valued or whatever, nobody's got any money to buy anything. And there's a whole bunch of people that need to raise money, so they're selling stuff at the market and there is no market. What's going to take it on the chin the worst? And I think junk bonds are a very high likely candidate.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I want to move on to their third point. The second point was the tail risk of private assets. We don't have time to go through every single one of them, but I want to move on to their third point. And their third reason for believing that liquidity will be a big issue is that increased assets under management of strategies that sell on autopilot. And essentially, they're saying that over the past decade, there was strong growth in this passive and systematic strategies that rely on momentum and asset volatility to determine the level of risk-taking, such as all the volatility targeting, the risk parity, the trend following, the option hedging funds, all of these that exist out there. And they went to demonstrate that a market shock would prompt these strategies to programmatically sell into the weakness. So you now have strategies that rather where before, like point one, where the value investors would be in there to scoop up any short-term weakness, now you have a scenario where these autopilot systems may actually sell into the weakness to actually accelerate it. And they go on to make the point that, for example, they estimate that the futures-based strategies grew by $1 trillion over the past decade. And more importantly, the options-based hedging strategies increased their potential selling impact from an average of 3 days of average futures volume to 7 days average futures volume. So what that's telling me, okay, you know, look, okay, so there's a whole bunch of market makers and people out there that go out and they'll take the short side of the options trade that everyone's buying for protection. But what happens is that they obviously have delta gamma risk. And so what happens is the market's selling and the gamma is forcing the delta to rise. They have to short more and more futures to actually stay delta neutral. And so when we have this massive market in the options that everyone is using these as protection, when these market makers become offside, they're going to have to go and hit that futures market hard to stay delta neutral. And so this could actually cause further selling to accelerate that way. What's interesting, because then the fourth point they get into is about the very trend liquidity provision that is market making. They go on to say, in market making. There's been a shift from human market makers that are slower and rely on valuation and reversion models to these program-driven liquidity models that are based on their volatility-based VAR models that basically adjust risk based on that liquidity provision. And the thing that they're basically trying to make the whole point of here is that they feel that with this movement to these VAR models, that they could very well have not only contributed to those little flash crashes we saw in May 2010, October 2014, and August 2015, but really that it's even worse today. You know, I kind of, that what resonated with me with when I read this is like, you know, I remember Einhorn basically compared VAR models, the value at risk models, to an airbag that works all the time, except when you have a car accident. And he further charged that when using VAR, it was potentially catastrophic when its use creates a false sense of security among senior executives and watchdogs. And so we have this scenario where we're seeing everyone moving toward these models. And I really kind of, what I get from Marco's article here is that whole Minsky thing where the stability actually is going to breed the future instability. And so this movement toward these different things may be where all the future problems lie.
You know, it really, just hearing that, it really made me think, Patrick, that if there is an answer to the question I've asked so many people, like Grant Williams last week, which is what's going to be the catalyst that really brings about the big crisis, the big one next time? What's it going to be? I'll tell you, my prediction is that it is automation. And what I mean by that, think about the story of the 1987 crash, the whole portfolio insurance debacle, where supposedly, you know, people were going to dynamically hedge. And as the market started going down, it's exactly what you said, Patrick, which is when the market's going down already into a collapsing market, they have to sell even more aggressively. Well, what happened in that case, and of course, in 87, futures were still traded in the open outcry pit. The guy that was responsible for selling the futures for this portfolio insurance product was on the floor, and he realized if he sold the number of futures contracts that he needed to sell according to their algorithms, he would have sent the S&P futures to zero. And so he just didn't do it. Well, guess what? The machines are not going to have that human sensibility. If they're programmed to sell in a certain circumstance, they're going to sell. And I don't know whether it's HFT. I don't know whether it is the automation of the market making process where the people who supply liquidity as market makers, which are now all automated, if they suddenly pull that liquidity as soon as the crisis starts, and then there is no natural liquidity in the market, and that's the cause. I don't know. But somehow the machines are going to not be programmed to do the right thing to save the day. That guy knew that he was basically compromising his own company, his integrity, and the investors that he was supposed to protect by selling futures. He knew he was doing something that was not in his own client's best interest, but he also knew that he was going to crash the market to zero if he did what they had planned to do, and he didn't do it. That's what humans do in a situation like that. Robots do it differently. So I don't know exactly where it comes from, whether it's high-frequency traders or market makers or whatever, but somebody's computer is going to do something scary at the worst possible time, and it's going to be ugly.
Now, Eric, I just want to touch on the two other big variables that he touched on. And they discussed this miscalculation of portfolio risk. He talks about over the past two decades, most risk models were correctly counting on bonds to offset that equity risk. And what's interesting is they make that observation that in the next crisis, bonds likely will not be able to offset equity losses due to obviously the low rates and already large central bank balance sheets. And what immediately I get from this is exactly to what you were talking about with these junk bonds. Now, you know, to me, I'm not a very big bond bearer when it comes to treasuries. In fact, I actually think treasuries may end up still acting as a safe haven asset, particularly if this comes with a recession and economic weakness, which could keep their yields low. But most people don't in their portfolios own treasury bonds. Most investors went out the risk spectrum to own higher yielding assets to get the yield pickup. So they're owning these corporates, the junks, the emerging market debt, other things where they can actually get the yield pickup. And so the question here and the point they're making is bonds may not act like an offset when you get out to that spectrum. They may actually contribute to the downside, and the experience investors have will be completely different. Now, in addition to that, they add on to the fact that valuations are excessive. And so we have these very expensive markets, and we have all of these considerations. It's really neat to think about some of the different drivers that they believe will drive this great liquidity crisis.
Yeah, it's a fantastic paper, and I definitely recommend our listeners take a look at it. And you said there was one more point after that.
Absolutely. Well, so I love the fact that they've coined this GLC, this great liquidity crisis, for the next crisis. But what's interesting is here, they almost get to a Neil Howe big picture kind of a fourth turning thing. And they start looking at the idea of what will be the impact of this next crisis. And they start comparing it a lot to what happened during the 1970s and the aftermath of 1968, and how it led to a revamp of the monetary system and all sorts of different things. And it led to that zero return lost decade of the 70s, leading to that famous Businessweek article, The Death of Equities, that was published in 1979. And so it's really interesting to see that not only did they talk all this quant things, but then they go and actually ask the question as to whether this is actually a bigger picture turn point in the financial markets.
Well, it was an excellent article, and I definitely recommend that our listeners give it a look. And again, you can find the link in your Research Roundup email. Speaking of which, for anyone who doesn't know, we really need you to help us to promote the program. And the most important thing that you can do is to register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free Research Roundup email, which never contains any marketing or advertising. It's just a compendium of links to the downloads that go with our feature interview presentations, such as today's download for Jeffrey Snyder's presentation, as well as all of the free content that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, let's go ahead and wrap it here. Tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, there's a whole array of different articles on there, but you'll find that transcript for today's interview with Jeffrey. So those that want to go back and absorb it by reading the content, it's a great way to kind of reinforce everything you heard on that. There's also the slide deck for the Eurodollar University, and the last pages that actually accompany this are now available. The whole chart book from start to finish is now out there. As well, the link to that Marko Kolanovic essay that we talked about and discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to a number of additional articles that Jeffrey Snyder wrote, including one that is titled Europe is Booming, Yet It's Not. And so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.